Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Voxology Podcast. Mike Erie, Tim Stafford, the Holy Spirit of Jesus of Nazareth. And we have a special guest today. Dr. Nijay Gupta is with us again. He wrote a book last year. We talked to him, Tell Her Story, about women and their elevated roles in leadership in the New Testament. Just wrote a book called Strange Religion. And we're getting away from doing people who are on book tours. Like, you know, I mean, there are loads of worthy books. But, you know, it also, if somebody's doing 90 podcasts, you know, about their book, it's like,
right,
you know, you're not always going to get a great sample of like what you thought made the book great. But for Nijay, man, this book, I actually endorsed it. So when I endorse books, which I'm rarely asked, but I actually read them. And I know, shocking, and only endorse the ones I really agree with. So if you open the front cover, there's Mike Erie right there. Now, I didn't make the back cover, which is where the big names go. And I'm joking. I think, you know, my endorsement will probably count against the book. But I wanted to just highlight that because I'm fascinated by the questions that he is exploring. Because we've talked to him, man, a bunch about evangelism and how was the early church so compelling? And the answer keeps coming back, whether it's from Kreider or now from our friend Nijay, it's the quality of the community that was so compelling. And the way that Nijay gets at this is he talks about what Roman religion was like, and he's very thorough in this. And then he just counters with what the Christians were preaching and doing. And you sort of just see it very classically, on its face. I mean, there isn't a lot of, you don't have to do a lot of interpretation to go, oh my goodness, they were saying that, and then the Christians were saying this. And for me, I love this. I love that we're getting the chance to talk with him. And by the way, Tim.
Yeah, Mike.
I want to comment on your Ramones hat. It's a new hat. I've not seen that hat. I really like it. I like that it matches your beard color and your flannel.
Yeah, I organically planned out my entire existence today to match.
Nice, dude. Well done.
Yeah.
I also, speaking of organically, I want to say thank you to people who were kind enough to email in about the parenting episode, who were very nice and gentle.
There's a lot of response to that.
I don't know what. I've been reflecting on what I was feeling, but because I want to be passionate, of course, in centered ways, not in bounded ways. So if I'm ever feeling like, oh man, I don't want to be so passionate that I'm saying to people, you know, unless you agree with me, you're out. That's bad passion in my
estimation. Well, it's interesting. I think that conversation from last week and this conversation are weirdly linked in one. In today's, we're taking like an academic kind of approach to it. Last week was like this really practical approach to, I think, the same ideas of like, this is what it looks like to do this in a way that is intentional and loving for the folks that are involved, in this case being your children. Yeah. And then we look at how what institution does and how it kills
right.
exactly that. So it's kind of an interesting, weird little tandem that just popped up in that way.
I love it. I absolutely love it. So anyway, it's about an hour long. So we're going to just wrap it. We'll do a short outro and we'll get into it, ladies and gentlemen. Ladies and gentlemen, just when you thought that one bald person was too much, today we have an extra special guest. And I don't know, I mean, bald isn't the word I would use for you, Nijay, but I would say you need to embrace it before long. We'll take a poll. We always want to start our interviews by complimenting our guests. And so that's kind of how we do it. Anyway, Dr. Nijay Gupta is with us today. And Nijay, you need to know several things about Nijay. Number one, he went to Miami of Ohio, which is my alma mater, Sky Jatani's alma mater. Number two, he is a video gamer, which I just think is rad, and plays with his kids, which is amazing. And then thirdly, this is the second time on our show because he is a freaking rock star stud, New Testament prof, who is doing some amazing, amazing work. And he just wrote a book called Strange Religion. And that I got to read an early copy of it, and I absolutely love it. So here's the subtitle, Tim Stafford: How the First Christians Were Weird, Dangerous, and Compelling. This is how I felt about girls when I was five. and so I think that's going to be my romance novel coming down the road. But Nijay, thank you for joining us. We're so glad to see you.
Great to be on again. I will say it's only the second time I've been on. I feel like you have my buddy Tim Gombas on every other week.
And
I keep checking my phone to make sure I have the same phone number, but I don't get a call it every other week. But speaking of titles, since you're talking about your crushes, the original subtitle, which they changed, and they changed it to the good, was How the First Christians Were Weird, Dangerous, and Attractive.
Oh yeah!
That fit even better.
Whoa!
Attractive may not be what you want to say. Okay, fine. That's compelling. That's more fair.
Did you come up with Strange Religion though? Was that you?
I did. I think the original was Weird Religion, and that was already a podcast, so I decided to change it to Strange Religion.
Oh man! But, yep.
Yeah.
And you have a podcast, right? You have a podcast.
Yes. So I have. A podcast I co-host with Dr. AJ Swoboda, the great theologian, Oregonian theologian. I'm a wannabe Oregonian, but AJ's the real deal. And it's called Slow Theology, and it's all about how to walk with Jesus through the messiness of real life.
Whoa. It's like the crockpot theology. It's like I'm a Midwest guy, so crockpot meals were great because you just let them simmer.
Guy.
All day. I know you are.
Except we did it in plastic back then. I don't know why we did that. But the little plastic liners. Why did they do
plastic
that?
Plastic can't.
Maybe that's why we went bald, Mike. it was plastic liners.
All right. So I have so many questions. And first of all, I don't there have been in the past interviews where we've been like, oh, this is like we think this is going to be an interesting book and we want our audience to know about it. But for you, man, we just really believe in you and what you're doing and how you approach things. And the book was killer. But I don't want to start by talking about the book because I think the book ties into some things that I'm super fascinated by. Like, so we've talked with our mutual friend, Tim Gombas, about the Great Commission not being the driver of evangelism for the early church, or even evangelism being like a thing that was super emphasized in the early church. And so I've been wondering a lot about why do you think it was that this vulnerable, tiny, fractional community on the edge of the Roman Empire became such a social force? Like if you were just sort of to paint a broad brush picture for why it is, what was it about the early Christians? If it wasn't that they were out evangelizing, like we would consider evangelism, what was it about them that made them so compelling?
Yeah, I mean, we might get back to this later. You have to understand the Roman world and what it was. So can I just paint a quick picture of what this world was like? I have six kind of elements that portray Roman religion, and the relationship between religion and politics was intertwined.
Mm-hmm.
Do we know what that's like in America? I think we do. I think we know what that's like in America.
Yeah.
So let me tell you the six. Roman religion, which we're talking about Jupiter and Mars and Pluto and all that, hierarchy. The world was built on a pyramid of power. You had the Olympians at the top, you had demigods, but then you had Caesar, emperor, right? Augustus. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Below that, you had the upper class, the senators, equestrians. Then you had the commoners, the poor, the slaves, and so forth. So Roman religion reinforced hierarchy. Number two, rituals of appeasement. The whole purpose of Roman religion was to safeguard the pax deorum, peaceful coexistence with the gods. The gods were not seen as like, Jesus is my co-pilot, Jesus is my homeboy. They were seen as overlords. They were like colonialists. They're taking over and you owe them everything. Mm-hmm. So religion was appeasement. You want to keep these gods happy. Number three, Roman religion reinforced elitism and limited access. So when you think of Roman priests, don't think of like a poor Jewish priest. Think of a senator that wants even more privilege and power, who buys his way into a Roman priesthood so that he can have access to the gods and he can limit access to the poor and other things. Number four, professional or cold reciprocity.
Yes.
And the whole idea is, I'll do you a favor, oh deity, if you do me a favor.
That's right. So it was beyond appeasement. It was almost like you kept them happy, but you expected something in return. So they were the ultimate patrons, and you were a client of the gods.
Yeah, think about who is the guy? Oh my gosh, I'm going to forget his name. He was Trump's attorney that got in a whole bunch of trouble.
Cohen? And
which one?
Cohen, Michael Cohen. Yeah, which one? Michael Cohen. So like, he's in deep with Trump.
Yeah.
So on the one hand, you don't want to offend Trump if you're him when you're his lawyer. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you actually want favors. So you're going to do all kinds of stuff to get fit. So that's what we're talking about, this professional. Like later on, he's like, this was really unethical. But in the moment, he's like, okay, I'm in the system too deep. I really want reciprocity. That's that's all Roman. All those ideas are just borrowed from Rome.
Yeah.
Number five, ultimate Romanness. Everything goes back to reinforcing Romanness, the Roman culture, which is all the above. And the last one is monoculturalism.
Yeah.
To be Roman meant everyone else was a barbarian. They literally use that word. Mm-hmm. Everybody else is a barbarian. Mm-hmm. And that's a way of deprioritizing cultural difference, language difference, dress, all of that. Monoculturalism. The whole reason I wrote this book is the Christians come along and they defy every single one of these.
Yeah,
and what's crazy is...
Go through them real quick.
Yeah,
Go ahead.
The crazy thing is you or I, we're willing to defy the status quo on one thing.
Yeah.
You know, like I'm going to wear pajamas to Trader Joe's. Like we're willing to do that.
You know, in the name of Jesus. Yes.
Or like I'm going to wear clashing colors, whatever it is. Like we're willing to do one thing.
Yeah.
But there's this there was this critic of Christianity, I think in the second century, Celsus. And he had this saying, which I discovered through Miroslav Volf. And I just love it because it's so cheeky. He says, if all men wanted to be Christians, the Christians would no longer want them. And his whole point is Christians are weird, dude. Yeah. His point is these people, you go right, they go left. You go up, they go down. Now, he's exaggerating, but what he's pointing out is from somewhere came this powerful, like meteor hitting the earth of cultural opposition. When I use the word strange, I'm talking about deviance.
Mm.
What leads Gandhi, for example, to be deviant in his world? Mm. What leads Martin Luther King Jr. to be deviant in his world? Mm. What leads Dietrich Bonhoeffer to be deviant in his world? And one of the connections between those three people is Jesus, right? Even Gandhi, not a Christian, but loved Jesus, read the Sermon on the Mount regularly and so forth. So let's go through these really quick. Hierarchy and classifications of power. The whole point, so Roman society worked on this pyramid where the fewest people at the top hold the most power, and then the great mass of people are at the bottom. And your goal in life in the Roman world is to stomp and scrape and fight to just get a little bit higher on the ladder of power.
Yes, yes.
Just a little. You're going to do mudslinger, do whatever it takes. You're going to stomp. And here Jesus, Philippians 2, though he was equal to God, meaning he's at the top of that pyramid. He is standing on the pinnacle of that pyramid. And the Father says, hey, I need a favor. And Jesus says, when, where? I'm going now.
I love that.
And he says, you're going to go down. And then he says, how far? You're going to go to the bottom. And then you're going to break the bottom because you're going to get crucified. You're going to go even further than the bottom because the lowest thing in the Roman Empire was punished slaves. Punished slaves were the worst. I mean, treason, but punished slaves were the worst. And here you have Jesus dying a criminal's death on the cross. Who would do that? Who
it
would
makes
do that?
No sense. No
this
sense.
This is their hero's song. This is
right.
Philippians 2 is the hero's song. I call it the ode. It's the ode to Jesus. So when people sing great songs, you know, it's funny. I was listening to Trevor Noah talk about how weird the national anthem is. Because most, like the German national anthem is like agriculture and, you know, harvest and fields, because they want to be all peace oriented because of, you know, things that have happened in the past. And then Trevor Noah's like, US is the only one where bombs are bursting. like our national anthem is the theater of war.
Yeah.
Like that's like when we say, like, who are we when we sing this song? And Trevor Noah's like, why do we do this at local sports games? Like, it makes sense at the Olympics. Why do we do it at local sports games?
Yeah.
This is all very Roman. Yeah. All of this stuff is Roman. But Christians come along, they say, our song is about humility. Our song is about self-lowering. Our song is about self-sacrifice. It's very different. And not just for our friends, not just for our in-group, but for our enemies.
That's it, man.
It's strange.
Yeah.
It's strange. We'll do a couple more, and then you can come back at me.
No, I love this.
Elitism and limited access. So if you wanted to be in on religion in the Roman world, you had to have money. It's like if you want to go to the Super Bowl, you got to have money. You want to go to the World Cup, you got to have – it's not an every person's kind of thing. And it was the same thing with Roman religion. Everyone could participate by turning on the radio. They didn't have radio. You could turn on the radio. But if you wanted a real experience, you had to have money, you had to have access, you had to have power. The Christians come along and they say, we have no temples. We have no priests. We have no sacrifices. We have no statues.
Crazy.
Now, that would be, Mike, like me saying to you, hey, I have this great idea for a school, but we're not going to have classrooms, building, teachers, or students, or textbooks.
Yeah.
You're like, okay, but like, what actually is it?
Yeah.
But that's what the Christians did. Like, if someone shows up to a Christian meeting in the middle of the first century, a Roman, and they're hanging out, they're looking around wondering, where are the sacrifices? Where are the priests? And then they say, oh, sorry, we don't have any of those things. And that was because Christianity launched what I call a religious technology revolution, much like the jump from landlines to cell phones, where you can worship God anywhere, no matter how much money you have. And it's no better. You can't, there's no more static in one part of the empire than another in your signal to God.
Yeah.
You don't get a clear signal in Rome. You don't get a clear signal in Jerusalem. You don't get a clear signal in Corinth or Ephesus. That was crazy.
Yeah.
Because in the Roman world, in order to worship a god directly, you had to be in front of him. Those are a few pieces of the puzzle here.
I want more. No, keep going.
You want me to keep going? Okay.
Yeah, no, I really do, because this, what you're painting is a very vivid picture. See, we think evangelism is individuals telling people a story about Jesus dying for their sins so they go to heaven and then praying to accept him in their heart. This was not what the early church was doing. It was far more radical and threatening than that. So I actually like, I mean, I'd like you to hit all six.
Yeah.
Because I don't think we, growing up in America, I don't think we can appreciate how outlandish this whole thing, not just what they believed, but what they did in response to what they believed was just crazy. So please, this is great.
Yeah. So let's do the rituals of appeasement, the Pax Deorum. So Rome believed that with your gods, the paradigm is basically government. They're rulers. They are divine, supreme rulers. And you're a peasant in the eyes of the gods. My kids and I and my wife are watching the Percy Jackson TV show at Disney Plus. And it's actually a pretty good reflection of Greek mythology that you have these humans, you have these demigods, and the high gods, they actually don't care much about that. Humans are expendable. They're like fleas. And you do these rituals of appeasement, just hoping and praying that you won't get zapped and you won't lose a war and all of that. And the Christians come along and they say, Christ died once for all to open up a pathway of love. Think about Hebrews. let us approach the throne of not power, not judgment, not condemnation, not even salvation. Let us approach the throne of grace.
Right. Unheard of.
Okay. But how should we approach the throne of grace? Sheepishly? No. With with confidence, with boldness, with frankness.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I hate when people interrupt me while I'm teaching on Zoom, but my kids do it all the time. And so I'll just hear That's a little fair. Knock because they don't know I'm in a meeting, and they'll just knock and be like, are you in there? And I'm like, just listen, I'm in it. But it doesn't bother me. I mean, it's annoying. It doesn't bother me because they're my kids. But if some random other person did, I'd bother. This is how God is. This is a whole different paradigm.
Right.
The idea that God loves you.
Mm-hmm.
This is a Christian message, right? But it wasn't a religious message at the time. God loves you and has a wonderful plan for your life? No way. Mm-hmm. There's no way that people thought. They thought the gods want something from you. They want duty. They want fidelity, pietas. They don't love you. Now, they might have sex with you. That's their choice. But they don't love you. And so this whole idea of appeasement, that probably was something that was hard for people to wrap their brain around because they're so used to that. And don't we sometimes feel that with our parents where we have this, I'm Indian. So I have this like, I want to make my parents happy. I want to make my parents happy. But with God, he's communicating, the God of scripture, Jesus Christ is communicating, none of that's important anymore. You thought that way before, none of that is important. There's a long-term conversation in history of religion scholarship, why people had sacrificed the ancient world. The gods need food. Yeah, no, they knew the gods didn't need food. They live on Olympus. They're not actually that hungry. They got their own food, ambrosia and whatnot. There's a theory by a scholar named F.S. Snyden, a historian, who says it was basically a gift to open up a channel of communication with a god. So I kind of think it like a quarter.
Like Valentine's Day. Like Valentine's Day.
Yeah. Yeah. But there's love in Valentine's Day and there's not love with this. It's like the coin in the payphone. It initiates the call. The call may go well or go badly, but it opens the channel.
Got it.
So why did sacrifices end in Christianity? You know, presumably they didn't do it after 70 AD when the temple was destroyed. It's not only because of atonement. Atonement is important, blah, blah, blah. But I think it's because you didn't need to give a gift of appeasement or a gift of opening a communication because Jesus is the living channel. Think about the old days. Both of you probably remember this, of dial-up internet.
Oh, it was glorious.
Remember all the bings and bongs?
Yeah.
And how that page would load, like it'd take 2 minutes to load the page. And you'd have to log on and log off. Remember we used to talk about logging onto the internet? But now we don't ever think about it.
Right.
We don't ever think. And only when you're in a tunnel or like in like the deep recesses of a building where you can't get internet, like there's this volleyball court that my daughter's in and doesn't have internet. And like, I panic. I'm like, I can't check anything in here. I'm going to suffocate and die. But Jesus, for the early Christians, was a living, always on, always open line of communication with a loving God, which the Romans didn't have. Nobody had this. I mean, the Jews had this to some degree. We could talk about them.
Yeah.
You could pray anywhere, but you wanted to be near the temple. David says, I wish I could be near the temple. I would be a doorkeeper rather than, you know, I'd rather spend time in the temple anywhere else. Christians never said that. This is really crazy. Think about it this way. Paul, who wrote these important letters, never tells Christians to go on pilgrimage anywhere.
That's so big.
Is that crazy? Because
that's
what you did in the ancient world. You saved up all your money. You set aside $5 a week so that someday you could go to the Disneyland of the ancient world, which was Rome or Ephesus or Jerusalem, so you could see these great spiritual sites. Christians never did that. They never said, you got to save up your nickels and dimes, kids, because you got to make it there someday. They never said that. What about gift giving? I'll do you a favor if you do me a favor. No, they never, Christians didn't do that. In Philippians chapter 4, Paul talks about this wonderful relationship of giving and receiving that Christians have. And God expects much from Christians, but he's not petty to the point where he expects you to give up all this stuff to him. He wants you to pay it forward to other people. Mm. So, for example, Romans 12, offer your bodies living sacrifices, holy and pleasing to God. This is your spiritual act of worship. Yes, you're giving yourself to God. But as we learn from 1 John, the Gospel of John, because he's given his up life up for us, we lay down our lives for others. Mm-hmm. So instead of being in this reciprocity with God, which we always are, we're actually meant to expand that gift giving outward to others. And that means we're never a closed circle of just scratching each other's backs. Mm-hmm. The early Christians were very insistent that we don't become a closed off club. We must expand generosity outward. What about Romanness and monoculturalism? One of the most offensive and craziest things that Paul ever wrote comes in Colossians, where he says, there is no more Scythian or barbarian. Mm. Now, most people don't know what that means, but let's start with Scythian. Scythian were basically rednecks. Mm. Rednecks, hillbillies, and hillbillies.
The Sith.
Now, I'm from a part of Ohio where there that could be identified as the land of rednecks and hillbillies. And I love my people. I love my people. But they're seen as cultural lowlife, so to speak. Mm. Would you say that's a fair? I don't want to.
Yeah.
But that's kind of how that terminology is used.
Yeah, when the barbarians wanted to call somebody a barbarian, they used the word Scythian.
Yeah, is
how I always heard it. It was like a lower caste than even barbarian.
Yeah, they're beneath you. Scythians are beneath you. And Paul says,
that's
no,
good.
we don't think about that. Now, barbarians, this is actually an onomatopoeia, meaning if I'm a Roman and I'm listening to someone speaking a foreign language. Mm. I don't want to learn that foreign language. I don't care about this person. So I'll say they're just saying bar, 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 bar. They're making fun of a foreign language when they're referring to somebody as a barbarian.
Huh. Oh, that's interesting.
So to call someone a barbarian is to say you are an outsider.
Mm-hmm.
You are an outsider.
And not even worth my time. Yeah. Not worth my time
to learn your language, learn your name. You know, when I was in high school, I worked at Walmart and my boss, you know, there's a group of us high schoolers that were new. My boss went around, what's your name? You know, Dan, Bob, whatever. And I said, Nijay. He said, what? Nijay. He said, I'm going to call you Jay. He just changed my name on the spot.
Yep.
That's a very Roman thing to do, is to say, you're a barbarian. You're different.
Bar.
Yeah, you're like that. And the Christians said, no. And then look at Romans 14 and 15. Paul says, hey, listen. One house church says we want to worship Jesus with these cultural practices. And another group says we want to worship with these cultural practices. And what's crazy is Paul says, that's okay as long as you don't look down on each other and that you believe what you believe because of theological conviction. That allows for diversity of culture. And unity of spirit. And Rome thought, well, if we do that, we're going to lose Romanness.
Yeah.
We're going to lose the essence of Romanness if we allow multiculturalism.
Mm-hmm.
Christians defied that. And they said, no, we're going to let Jews live Jewishly and Gentiles live Gentile-ly. Mm-hmm. Paul's writing, this is crazy. Think about this. In Paul's letter to the Romans, Paul's a Jew writing in Greek to the capital city of the Roman Empire.
Yeah.
I mean, that just shows you the adaptability of Christians. So you asked the million-dollar question, what were people's reactions to the Christians? I would say the general reaction is weird, as in, this is outside the box.
They were superstition, not a religion initially. Is that right?
Yeah, there was a designation of religio, which means, you know, Rome had a tolerance policy with outside religions because they conquered a bunch of nations. They said, okay, we'll let you privately worship your gods. And some of them became famous in the Roman Empire, popular. And even Judaism had some popularity. Josephus says there are Jews in every city. But they wanted to make sure that even though they had kind of an open border policy, they wanted regulations at the borders for what would be a good religion versus a bad religion. So religio means good, superstitio, superstition means bad. And so you wanted it to have clear rules to the religion. Christians didn't have that. You wanted it to not to have professionals that are safeguarding the religion, like priests. Christians didn't have that. You wanted to make sure the deity was as old as possible. Do you have ancient records? Christians didn't have that. They're like, literally, Jesus was born yesterday.
Yeah.
No, they're like, Jesus was born. You know, we know his parents. Like that's that didn't fly with a lot of Romans. But the Romans. So they were weird in the sense that they didn't use the traditional infrastructure of most of the religions of the time. And so some would have found it weird. Many would have found it dangerous. Look at the book of Acts.
Yeah.
They're proclaiming another king
Lord. Yep.
Other than Caesar.
Yeah.
Right? They're turning the world upside down. They're casting these demons out, these spirits out of these money-making prophets, like in Philippi. They're convincing magicians who are earning. Don't think of David Blaine here. Think of sorcerers. think of Doctor Strange here.
Yes,
and the Sorcerer Supreme. Yeah, they're money makers, and they're frustrating. They're frustrating the empire economically. They're frustrating the empire in terms of the Pax Deorum. Because if you're saying here's one thing I hope you guys find really interesting, and I only realized this when I researched the book. To say Jesus is Lord of all was a really striking claim, because even Zeus, i.e. Jupiter, didn't often claim being Lord of all. There wasn't the sense that there was one great God over every single person. There was a sense of like who's stronger, who could win in a wrestling match. But this idea of total supremacy, it actually only started to become more popular when Rome moved from a senatorial-led republic to an empire under one emperor.
Dun, 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 yes. Dun, 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 dun,
yes. Dun, dun. It is just what you think. This is very parallel. So what happened was Rome started off in the good old days, very strong, very powerful, and they became very rich. And then people started to get lazy because they just were enjoying their wealth. They were becoming complacent. So you had all these writers, all these Roman writers who are complaining about the old glory days, which are fading, a kind of make Rome great again.
I don't see any parallels right now.
No, I just came up with that. And then in the first century, you see people rallying around one hero figure, which is Octavian.
Yes.
And Octavian says, humbly, I would like to be the boss. I'd like to be an emperor. And I think if I can get everybody on one page, if I can get everyone unified under my power, then we will be able to restore the glory of Rome. And he had backers like Virgil, as in Virgil's Aeneid, who believed Augustus would reign in a new golden age. And only then do we start to see deities of the Roman world start to make claims of absolute supremacy. That's really interesting. So once we have the imperial era with the reign of emperors, now we see statues of the emperors. I'm looking at one on my screen right now of Claudius, Emperor Claudius, dressed as Jupiter. Zeus, essentially. When Augustus died, when his body was taken in procession, he was dressed as Jupiter. There becomes an alignment between the human power and the divine power. And Christians did things differently. They were actually very critical of accumulation of human power. And even in a reference, I can't remember if it's 1 Peter or not, but in a reference to the emperor, he refers to him as a created one, meaning he's only a creature.
Love that.
He's not really divine. He's only a creature.
Yeah.
And even when Paul says there are many gods and lords, says we really know there's not.
Yeah.
You can call them that, but put them in quotation marks.
Right.
But then you asked a question, what would have made this compelling? That was your, about 30 mm-hmm. minutes ago, you asked me, mm-hmm. what made them compelling? What made them attractive, you might
say?
Well,
you're answering it, yeah. Attractive would be a much better word there. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, what I want to say is, hey, it's theology. I actually think it was the community.
Mm-hmm.
It was the compelling vibrancy. Community. Because if you just stop somebody on the street in Rome in the first century and started to tell them what's going on in the Gospels, it's either going to be too confusing to understand, too mm-hmm. off-putting, or it'll just take too much time. So my guess is people invited their neighbors over for a Christian gathering, and they start to look around and they start to see the paradigm shift away from the gods as overlords to father and son as loving caretakers. Jesus, the big brother, and God, the father, and the spirit as the glue that bonds everyone together. And instead of being in a temple, you're afraid of saying the wrong thing or doing the wrong thing or getting zapped. You're in a family gathering where the leader of the gathering is saying to a slave, what do you think about the message? Yeah. Or how do you understand this verse? And you have women who are hosting, like Nympha of Colossae, or Priscilla and Aquila co-leading a house church. And there's conversation, there's community, there's food. Paul has to actually criticize the Corinthians for turning the Lord's table into a competitive dinner party where you're trying to one-up each other.
Yeah.
The Met Gala. He's like, no, this ain't the Met Gala, okay? There's no red carpet here. This is a family meal, and we need to treat each other like equals. Totally. I think there's the power of that. But I think, theologically, the most compelling message was God is for you. I remember hearing a theologian, Charles Cranfield, say that if I had to sum up Paul's gospel in one of his texts, it would come from Romans 8. If God is for us, who can be against us? He said those words, God is for us, no matter who you are, no matter what family you come from, where you live, what language you speak, God is, no matter what you've done, and no matter what you will do, God is for you. The Roman Empire was a place of insecurity for everyone but the very top, and even then you could get stabbed like Julius Caesar.
Totally, totally.
To live in that world and for someone to say the greatest being in all of time and space has your back. That's amazing.
Seriously. I have a two-parter that's going to take another half hour. So, first of all, I love this. I want to briefly, and Tim, you'll be in this with me. I'm struck by, and you and Sky, when you did the Holy Post interview, you and Sky started this way, or you got here. But I want to go here, and then I want to take it a step further. But I'm struck by how, over the course of, 20 centuries or whatever it is, Christianity has come to model the six things that characterize Roman religion.
Yeah.
So I was kind of wondering if we could just go through those six real quick, if you would just say them, and then the three of us would say, hey, what are evidences that that's here? Because where I want to go is, how do we make Christianity weird again?
Weird again. Thank you. Thank you, Mike.
That's where I want to go. But I want to set it up by saying, hey, we do have 20 centuries or 21 centuries of evidence that we're a lot like the Roman Empire. And this is where you and Sky went. But I want to use those six characteristics of Roman religion to do it.
I think we're going
to
make red hats too that just say make Christian. We'll send you one.
Make. Okay.
It would be great. All right. What was number one?
Hierarchy, classes, and tiers of power and privilege.
Come on. Do we see this today, gentlemen?
Oof. Yeah, obviously.
This week.
I think one of the, I'll tell you a story, which is really disheartening. I I mentioned I grew up in Ohio, and I went to a pretty affluent church, and there was a pastor in the church. This was 20, 30 years ago, long time ago. And he said he had a heart for blue collar people, but he said blue collar people will never go to this church. So I need to go and do a blue collar church plant. The idea that we would have to succumb to those dividing lines in order to have a church is very Roman. To say we have a separate church for the blue collar than we do for the white collar.
Yeah.
That's power. That's classifications. That's class, right?
Yeah, absolutely it is. Absolutely. We're churches in certain zip codes versus churches in other zip codes. I mean, it's absolutely. And celebrity, the celebrity dynamics of Christianity also foster that sort of us, them, insider, outsider sort of thing. Tim, you want to add anything under that label?
No, I was definitely thinking about this week, though, with never mind. Just keep going. That'll sidetrack us.
You're the best.
Now we're curious, Tim.
Yeah, seriously. All right, what's number two?
Number two, appeasement, appeasing God.
Oh, yes, because we're going to burn in hell otherwise, man. Come on.
Well, you see all these interpretations of what's going on in the world as judgment. So two examples come to mind is 9/11. Oh, 9/11 happened because America's not Christian enough, or the Muslims are winning, whatever. And then if you guys remember on the West Coast, we had the Fukushima incident.
Reactor,
That led to a big tidal wave and all these issues. And people blame that on Japan not being Christian enough, that God would judge them with that. And this idea that God's got a short fuse. He's petty. And he's going to throw the lightning bolt, which is a very Zeusian image, whenever we do something naughty.
Yeah. I also think of the positive side of that, like, hey, give money to God and God will give money to you, or be pure and then God will bless you with your, you know, greatest sexual fantasies or whatever. Like it's the dynamic of reciprocity, you know, it's not just appeasement, like I want to avoid hell, but now it's reciprocity where, well, I've done this for God. God kind of owes me.
And we see a challenge there because texts like Book of James and Proverbs do affirm that you should, if you do wise things, generally speaking, but we take it too far and we say, God, if I do this, you owe me.
Yeah.
If I do these things for you, you owe me. That's a dangerous game. And actually the early Christians spoke a lot about suffering as not divine retribution, but opportunities to grow. Now, they actually had similarities then with Roman philosophers like the Stoics. But Paul says to the Philippians, for example, who are going through a lot of suffering and wonder why the gospel isn't good news in that situation. He says, it's been given to you not only to believe in him, but to suffer for his sake. And that really changes the paradigm of how we look at suffering, not as, what did I do wrong? My youngest daughter, she was diagnosed with cancer when she was 1 year old. She's cancer free many years later, but, not once did I think that this was divine judgment, and not once did I think that God did this to my child, but I always think about how God is going to use this to make her a stronger person. I would never wish it on anybody. When people get cancer, I pray it goes away. For the people that don't have cancer, I pray you never get cancer. And I never would say I'm glad she had cancer, but it's actually made her a very strong human being. If you ever met her, you'd be like, wow, she has the soul of a 90-year-old. She's tough as nails. But Christians, they actually found a way to not connect cause and effect.
That's good. That's good.
With, okay, if I do this, I'll get this outcome.
Yeah.
Yep.
You leave judgment to the one who judges justly, meaning Christians don't take vengeance. We let God do the justice thing eventually.
Yeah.
I use this little sermon bite with students sometimes. According to scripture, what's right will come to light eventually. The balance in the world will come eventually. But one of the things I love about Christianity is it's always been real. It's always been real and saying, hey, I'm going to give you this Christianity thing, but it's not always going to be warm fuzzies. Mm-hmm. AJ does this thing, AJ Swoboda, he talks about on our podcast sometimes, where when he was pastoring, he would invite newcomers to come to a get to know the church. And they would come, and then he would tell them all the bad things about the church. And I said, why would you do that? And he says, because if they stay, then I know that they're not going to be shocked by who we are. And they know that I've been honest with them from the beginning.
I love that.
I think Christians were like that. They were people like that.
Yeah. All right. Give me number three real quick. Reciprocity, right?
We did that one, but elitism and limited access.
Oh, come on now. Come on now.
I want to hear from you guys. I got all kinds of ideas.
Well, one of the things, so when I was a senior pastor of a very large church, I had a security team. I had gatekeepers. I had, you know, assistants and people that read my emails and filtered my emails. Like no way you could get to me unless I wanted, you know, I mean, so that's a tiny little example, but it was very much like, time with me. I mean, I'm really busy, guys. So time with me is a big deal. We didn't say it that way, but that was sort of the implication. So that was limited access. I also think churches that really focused on boundaries limit access to God unless it's through the proper channel. So if you've been baptized this way or you need to speak in tongues or whatever, I think that's another example maybe of that. What would you say, Tim?
We've been in fights with our the school board here lately, who is trying to implement a bunch of policies that are not favorable to the children. And one of the people that keeps showing up all the time is this universalist pastor in town who uses different pronouns than Christians are used to and has jewelry and the whole thing. But he is the most approachable, friendly, loving, intentional, and direct person usually in that room. And while it's not a Christian, he's been such a great example of somebody who's because he has a collar on. So when he walks in the room, everybody immediately thinks that he's a notch above, just because we have that response to that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And I know this isn't directly what you guys are saying, but this thing that popped in my head is just that how he has postured himself and modeled himself has been one that cares about the community. He's always there and he's always advocating for the least of these. And it's been inspiring in that way of how he's lowered all pretenses. Mm-hmm. And I think he wears the collar to do that very thing, to lower a pretense and an expectation that people have that make him seem like he's kind of untouchable or out of the way or condemning or judgmental.
Yeah. I think it's important. I get so worried about one thing I've talked a lot with my students about is the person you hear the most on Sunday morning is inevitably going to be the framework for how the people in the church see God.
Yeah.
So if they only hear one voice, and that voice is just one slice of the human race, people inevitably start to hear God's voice as Tim Keller's voice. And there's nothing wrong with Tim Keller, but pick your favorite preacher.
Yeah.
And so it's, you know, so the question is, who gets the microphone and for how long? And I really believe it's okay if the pastoral leadership team may be the most authoritative voice in the church because of training and calling. But in terms of the amount you hear their voice, I've gone through a paradigm shift in how I think about church over the last 10 years. And I use a sports analogy. You guys might like this. According to Ephesians 4, the church is meant to be like a beautiful game, like soccer. And if a coach is doing his or her job well, the camera isn't supposed to be on the coach during the game. It's supposed to be on the beautiful game and the players. And that's the people of God.
Come on.
And so if all you're doing is quietly facing a microphone, and that microphone is speaking for 80, 90% of the time you're together, what you're really saying, and I think it's inadvertent for most people, what you're really saying is that person is what's important, that person speaking. And I wonder why we don't hear more from other people in the church. I think it's partly lack of planning, but it's also lack of vision of the gifting of the people of God to build up each other. to build up. There's this word in Greek that's all over the New Testament, allelos, which means one another and vice versa. One to the other and vice versa. And I don't think we're vice, and that's part of the professionalism. We're over-professionalized. And I was just listening to a couple podcasts. I think Jean-Marc Copern was talking about this, that we have too high expectations that the person speaking is going to be the best preacher I've ever heard.
Yeah.
Because we have access to these great sermons on YouTube and on podcasts.
Yeah.
We put too much pressure on our pastors to be TED Talk speakers with brand new ideas every week that are going to blow people's minds and get millions of downloads. My coworker and my close friend, Scott McKnight, has a really simple statement about pastoral ministry. He says, pastors pastor people. It's the simplest statement, but he says people get off track so much because they want to have a speaking ministry and they want to have a book writing ministry and they want to go on a global tour and they want to have a cardboard cut out of them and they want to be invited to speak at every pastor's conference in the world. And pastors pastor people. They pastor human beings. They know the people and they listen to the people and they let the people speak. And when we give in to elitism and limited access, then we say, I know what God's thinking and I know how to interpret the Bible and you don't. Therefore, the people of God need to hear from me and not you, because you're going to botch it up because you're just you're just a regular person.
Right.
Yeah.
And you're a barbarian for all I care.
Bar, bar, bar.
Yeah.
Bar, bar. But be a risk taker and say, how do we make sure that people know the great and beautiful things that people are doing in this church for people inside and outside this church?
Yep. I love that. Do you have, I know you've got to run. Do you have, do you have like 3 minutes?
Yeah.
And if you don't, that's totally fine. Okay.
The buses will wait.
You've started on this. So how do we make Christianity weird again? Let's say we put you in charge of training pastors, which you do.
Oh man, this is a whole other podcast.
Pressure.
Yes. So, I mean, what are some, so like I'd speak probably 80% of the time at our church.
Yeah.
And we view our church meetings as staff meetings, right? The goal isn't to, that's not the action. That's preparation for, whatever, but that's a good challenging thing for me to hear. What are other things you would do to make Christianity weird again in American culture?
They're all pretty basic and obvious, but I just want to flag them and put them on the radar.
Do it.
When I see Christians on social media or in person or whatever, just acting like jerks. I want to use stronger language, but acting like jerks.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder, have they ever read the Sermon on the Mount? Like, do they really know the teaching of Jesus? Have they really committed themselves to that? So I'm like, read your Bibles and say, am I really committed to this? So we need to reinforce a new rule of faith. Because you can pick and choose things from the Bible and use it to justify your jerkiness. Yeah, it's easy just to say, oh, well, the prophets, you know, were jerks, so I could be a jerk too. But the rule of faith, the heart of the theology of Scripture is found in the teachings of Jesus and the lifestyle of Jesus, which is cruciform, which is service, which is humility, which is gracious. I think that's one of the key factors. The second one I'd mention, and again, this is the simplest thing. Do I have a genuine relationship with Jesus Christ? I think we need to sit down. We need to take a time out from ministry, sit down with every single ministry leader in the United States. I'm not kidding.
I love it.
And say, like, do you have an authentic, humble, passionately in love relationship with Jesus Christ? Or are you just a great performer and this is just a great fit for you, for your skills?
Yeah.
And then you're eventually going to gravitate towards narcissism. You know, Scott McKnight, again, one of the things he says, the pulpit attracts narcissists.
Totally.
Dude.
So it's an occupational hazard. And same thing with professors. Yeah. I'm in the same, many of us who are midlife are going through this midlife crisis of, was this ever for the right reason? Or did I just happen to step foot in a church and they said, let's put this person on a stage.
Yeah,
totally. Right? I think of Alexander Hamilton. Let's get this guy, Mike, put him on a stage. So many of us are talented, But the reason we're seeing so many pastors fall from grace, and it's not, I don't think it's happening in more numbers. I think it's that we're able to expose them now. I think it's because of the lack of opening up the heart. Because every time I hear about a new scandal, my wife's a pastor and a therapist, I think these people need therapy. And I'm not saying that in a mean way. I'm saying that to say, to be a serious and quote unquote successful big church pastor, you kind of have to close your heart. You kind of have to close yourself off. And the danger is then you lose that vitality connection to Jesus, where he's going to send an electric charge when you're doing all these crazy things, abuse and stuff, and lying and cheating and embezzling and all of that.
Yeah.
Is it in your heart? Like, I've been reading Augustine lately, and I think Augustine was right. It's it's the number one question we have to ask of our pastors and Christian leaders is, have you given your life to Jesus? It's a real question that I don't think many of them are asking on a daily basis. And Paul says, I'll end with this. Paul says in Galatians, I've been crucified to the world and the world has been crucified to me. And that means in order to take this high holy calling of becoming a Christian, and on top of that being a leader, I have to die to everything but Jesus. I have to die to reputation. I have to die to book deals. I have to die to podcast numbers. I have to die to reputation, to using the letters PhD all the time, or using the title pastor. I have to die to all those things. And it's not a one and done. It's a daily. Paul says in Corinthians, I die daily. I think a pastor, Christian leaders need to be asked every single day, either directly, indirectly, metaphorically, is today a day you're going to die? And if not, then you need to step away.
Come on. We've died to podcast numbers a long time ago. So, DJ, we love you. Thank you.
You got to have to come back, because I feel like this was...
Let's do
very,
a second.
Very tip of the iceberg.
Let's do it.
Yeah. Part I also want to know what it's like to be married to a therapist.
Yeah. I get a lot of free advice.
All right, bro. Get out of here.
All right.
We'll, yeah, we're proud of you and
thank
love
you.
Love your work,
thank
man.
You.
Thank
Thanks
you.
Thanks for supporting it.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Tim Stafford, we have to agree that you talk too much.
I know.
On that. And... But what were you thinking? Yeah, I saw the wheels turning. You were writing down a couple of questions.
Well, it's like at the end, I told him he's going to have to come back, because I feel like that was like just the tip of the iceberg kind of.
Yeah.
Like there was a lot there, but that was like a very small piece of the puzzle. And I love like I didn't want to interject because I loved everything he was saying, what you guys are talking about. I want to hear, I'd love to really get into the nitty gritty, like to take a step out of the academia and be like, okay. Cause I was like, I made a joke about this week, but like this morning, Trump was up there talking about taking Christianity back for the nation and all this stuff. And just this long Christian rant. And then the thing that I sent you and our mutual friend about, at the CPAC thing about the guy talking about ending democracy, and we didn't achieve it on January 6th, but we're going to achieve it. We will still endeavor to do so, and we'll take back the country in the name of God. I'm like, wow, this is really this Christian, this marrying of the state and the church is like, maybe it's death rattles, but it's definitely like they're the loudest voices in the room right now. And so seeing all that and then reading stuff about what Nijay's arguing about Rome and how the church stood out in deference to, like, just like there was a clear disparity between the two of them.
Totally, man.
It's just hard not to sit here and look around and be like, what in the world? Like, we are
totally
emulating the wrong version of this 100%. So,
yeah. Yep. Well, and I think you see, you know, when he was talking about how Rome became rich and then, you know, sat in its luxuries. I almost feel like that's kind of the American church, at least my branch of the American megachurch, there's so much money there, and there's so much money in Christian publishing and Christian songwriting. Like, of course those things would be corrupted.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
You guys are talking about something in there. I was trying to write down notes about something having to do with like kind of buying favor,
mm-hmm.
and how this Christian message was not about like that God was giving you love for free, but asking you to in turn give that to
pass it on,
not give it back. And so I started, my brain immediately started running through everything where it's like all the conversations we've had about worship, all the conversations we've had about like communion, all these different things that we still treat as transactional,
mm-hmm.
prayer, and how, and then you see that modeled through Rome and Roman gods, and how we still get stuck in that stuff.
Totally.
It again complicates worship to a certain extent. And
well, I mean, I don't know that it has to complicate it for me. I mean, for me, loving others is the same thing as loving God. So that's why worship is justice, right? There's no distinction between the two.
Yeah. And I think I mean, like with the worship that we,
we
have known as worship. it's about just, you know, like you say, the pep rally for Jesus, or just giving this often empty praise or emotional praise, or I don't know, just that you can go down the list, but this idea that God just like, I'm giving this to you.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had that framed as giving it to us, but we don't deserve it. We're wretched, yada, yada, mm-hmm. yada. But more like mm-hmm. God's invested and loves and gives mm-hmm. this, and then says, pass it on, like give it away, mm-hmm. do what I'm doing. And
chili peppers.
Give it away now, guys.
Yeah. I mean, to quote the great prophet, Anthony Kiedis.
That's funny because my master's thesis was on the power of the written word and kind of what words can do. And I was looking at Walt Whitman and Sylvia Plath and Anthony Kiedis.
Oh, come on.
Just because of some of the lyrics that when I was in like junior high, and I was like, I didn't know people could say this kind of stuff. Not for the good, not for the better, but just like the power that those words carried. I was like, holy moly.
Yeah. Oh my goodness, dude. That might be the coolest dissertation title ever. So, and we're going to have Nijay's co-host, AJ, on here. I don't know. I'm waiting for a copy of his book, but it's called The Gift of Thorns.
Ooh, we've had him on before. Yeah.
We have. He's just a great, like, so.
Something about Portland.
I mean, we love the Portlanders. They know weird. They know about weird. So let's title this episode, How Making Christians or Christianity Weird Again.
I don't know, but I was serious. I think we should. I'm gonna print some red hats that say "Make Christianity Strange Again."
Weird again, strange again. I like it.
We'll have them in the box.
What's the abbreviation of that? Make MCWA. MCWA. There's our new rap group right there. Anyway, if you would want to explore more, like here's something we could do. Nijay would totally come on again. Do you have questions out of this episode that you'd love to ask him? So how about this? What if you want to email in at hello@voxpodcast.com and
Nijay questions in the subject bar.
Yeah. And Nijay is spelled Nijay.
Yeah.
And let's have him on and let's talk more about this. I think that'd be really fun. Look at us.
Look at us go.
Look at us go. Look at us. We love you. We love us.
Non-frances closed.
Non-frances closed.
Closed. People have been invited.
Which is so fun.
It's all happening.
It's happening.
And we still want to do the one for listeners at some point.
Yeah, we got to figure that one out.
Yeah.
As soon as we get all this worked out. Absolutely. So friends, Romans, countrymen and women, thank you for lending us your ear.
Never more
appropriate. Have a great day. Yes. Yeah. Barbarians. I just remember there were cartoons produced by Hanna-Barbera.
Yeah.
And back when I was a kid, and I always thought Barbera was pronounced Barbarian,
the elephant.
There was a bear, right? Or was it elephant? No, it was an elephant.
I know.
See, oh, that's
those are
Roman,
the weird things
bro.
That my brain will hold on to. Is like, now I'm going to be walk. That bar thing is going to be.
It's funny.
Forever.
It did. It doesn't. There's not a lot that gets in there, but when it's in there, it's in there.
I don't have a lot of space,
bro. Let me tell you right now.
I don't know how to delete files.
That's so good. Tim Stafford, as you know, if you listen carefully to his comments, is a pop culture machine when it comes to references. And so I miss the vast majority of it, but we have people that email in and say, oh yeah, I got that. I saw what you did there. I'm like Captain America. I'm like Captain America in the first Avengers movie. Like I get maybe 10%.
I understand that reference.
Yeah, exactly. I write it in my little book. All right. Have a great day. We'll see you later.
Thank you, thank you, thank you for listening to this conversation. The Voxology Podcast is a 501c3 nonprofit organization that is made possible by listeners just like you. If you'd like to partner with us, you can do so at patreon.com/voxologypodcast or on Tithely, tithe.ly, search Voxology Podcast. You can interact with the hosts on Facebook /Voxology Podcast or on Instagram @Voxology Podcast and on Twitter or X, whatever it is, @MikeErie. Thank you, thank you, thank you for walking this long road with us.